If serial presentation is internal to the universe, then the first rotation in the plate of a simultaneous equilibration. This being so, can it be said that the Father is not sure whether the Son will manifest himself? Yet if all that is all that is, always was, and always will be, then the Son must already have been manifest. This is going to be a very tricky one. Before the first rotation, before cannot mean in the time sense, in the center. Before the first rotation has no temporal significance at all. The word before must be, in this context, a spatial word. Consider before and after a space. Imagine this circle upon the ground, and a man is standing outside it and facing it. He sees it before him. There's an end eye looking at it. He sees it before him. This is a spatial statement, not a temporal statement. If you think about it in the temporal sense, it becomes nonsense, because the first rotation means the rotation that is the head of the series of all rotations, whatever. So the word before must here be understood to refer to a spatial analogy. Consequently, we have to say before the first rotation is the state of God's Spirit prior to rotation, so that we take the paper and don't draw the circle on it at all. And we're going to see the kind of motion that is in the God, that is in the sentient substance, spirit, prior to any creation whatever. Now, as the first rotation is the beginning of the time process, before this rotation cannot be a temporal statement. Before the first rotation, generating the time process, there is only eternity. There is only the eternity of sentient substance itself, sentient power. Let's see what anxiety means in relation to this. If we look at the root of it, root ang, anxiety, the G becomes an X and an S. S, function. Ang means the absolute power, motion of it, and the central precipitation. Notion. So we can draw, if we like, the letter alpha, and we can say the whole letter is representing the V of the sign of the ram, and the closure, the circle of the O, that is the big O, the omega, and the energy coming into it, circulating and going out again, the transcendent V, prior to the O, to be considered simultaneously, constitutes the Aleph or Alpha spirit. It is a spirit that is absolutely transcendent, and yet within itself produces these zones of rotation. This is the meaning of the letter A. It implies transcendence and creation. The letter N signifies both to move and to negate. Because when motion occurs, motion is in a direction. And this direction negates other directions. And if you put down a series of motions, no matter how many directions we put them, each one, insofar as it is a linear progression of force, is negating all the other directions. Now if we put down all the motions, whatever, of the absolute, in their totality they constitute absolute motion, all the motions there are, but any one of them taken separately from the others negates the others. That means it cuts out the directions that other motions have in the act of concentrating its own force in its own direction. So let's say that the letter N means motion and negation, relative motion. that it is relative motion as opposed to absolute motion is the idea of a motion abstracted deliberately from the absolute and considered in a finite setting in order to determine its direction. So if we scribble lines all over the paper until we fill the paper up with lines until it's blacked out, the totality of all those lines of motion would constitute absolute motion. But any single one of them taken out would be a relative motion. That would be symbolized by the letter N. And in being relative, it is negating, cutting out the other motions which it is not. So the alpha or aleph, the letter A, symbolizes the absolute, which contains within itself all creation, and yet transcends it absolutely. It contains relative motion within it, that is, the motion which, when abstracted out from other motions, becomes relative to us, and also it contains within itself centers of precipitation, symbolized by the hard letter G. So the root ang, base of anger, anxiety, and so on, symbolizes an absolute motion with relative motion within it and zones of condensation inside. Now, if we like to represent this motion as a series of intersecting lines, wherever these lines occur, crossing each other, they generate points. Now, each little crossing point, by rotation, produces a zone of condensation, of turbulence. Each one of these is like a little hard letter G. Wherever this intersection occurs, there is rotation, turbulence, and relative compaction of forces, the generation of hard G. The whole thing is the aleph, the relative motion is the N, the compact points are the G. Now, the total simultaneous presentation of these three types of concept add up to the meaning of the root ang, basis of anxiety, anxiousness, anger, and so on. So when we say that God was anxious before the first rotation, we are simply indicating that the absolute motion contains within itself relative motions and intersection points of these motions within itself, and each intersection point is the generation of a finite locus, and this finite locus itself is a zone of limitation imposed upon itself by its spirit within itself. Now, the moment this state exists, we see the possibility of the anxiety. Each intersecting zone of forces might possibly get fixed. That is, the forces intersecting can rotate. When they rotate, they might get their tails in their mouths, like little serpents, and go round and round and round, and they might go round forever. Now, if they do so, and they never break out, they are said to be in hell. They are like little material particles. We know that material particles are simply tiny packets of force rotating and suffering from impulsations, pressures on centers and from centers, generating these rotations. You know that every such center is a center of pinned energy, energy which of itself is free, but which at the rotation points of the intersecting forces is not free but domed. Between all these centers, there is the free, but on all the centers, there is the dome. And here is the ground of the anxiety. The anxiety is twofold. Part of the anxiety is the anxiousness of the void, that we may never quite make it, we may never quite establish a body, an integrated form to which we can refer. And the other one is that if we do make a body, we may never get off it. We might actually be pinned down. So in the same way, when a boy is studying for an exam, His anxiety consists in, firstly, that he may not be able to cram the knowledge in that he needs. He can't get the form. Secondly, if he does get any given form, it might block him from getting some other form. He finds that in learning one thing, he's not learning another. If he's doing a lot of subjects all at once, he may find that each subject learned tends to exclude the other subjects that he needs to know. So the anxiety in him is twofold. The anxiety that he may not make the grade, he may not get the formal knowledge that he needs, and the anxiety that if he does get some formal knowledge, it might pin him on that knowledge and stop him gaining the transcendence he needs. So we can say that in the Absolute Spirit of God, there is a twofold anxiety, the anxiety of being void and the anxiety of being existent. This is the same as the twofold anxiety of Hamlet. When Hamlet says to be or not to be, he is experiencing a dual anxiety. Suppose when we say one of these zones of turbulence is the body that Hamlet is referring to. He's not all the body because he's got a mother and an uncle and various other people to deal with. He's identified with one of these centers of precipitation. And when he's saying to be or not to be, he's saying it because to say to exist or not to exist is less strong as a poetic form than to be or not to be. He is saying, which is the better, to be finited or to be non-finited? If we are non-finited, have we then no problem? And is the state of no problem to be preferred to the state of problem faced? If we are finited, certainly we have a problem and we have to take up arms against the sea of bubbles or troubles and do something about them. All the other centers are the troubles or turbulation zones that Hamlet is going to attack if he chooses to exist. And when he contemplates the kind of fight against all the other centers of initiative within the field, he thinks it's rather a big job, and he says, why not commit suicide? Why not just stick in the bodkin and lapse into non-existence? But at this point, he draws a parallel between death and sleep, and says that death is like sleep, and in sleep one may dream. And in the dream one may suffer as if one were not dead. What control have we over the dream if we have no physical body in which to wake up and come back to a concrete reality? In that sleep what dreams may come must give us pause, he says. And we know that we've ever experienced a deep nightmare and been immobilized in it and been struggling to try to wake up, perhaps pursued by some horrible, undefinable boy, or having some horrible thing form us sitting on the chest. It's a very unpleasant experience. We struggle, usually, well, most of us who are here at the moment, if we have experienced it, have managed to wake up out of it. And we find a tremendous relief when we are able to focus on the physical body that we have and to look round the room and familiarize ourselves with the external objective world, because it serves as a center whereby we can stabilize the content of consciousness on the objective sense world. It rescues us from the flux of feeling that exists beyond the centers of precipitation. So we see that the points of precipitation, the gross material particles that constitute our gross physical body, are useful to us because they enable us to concentrate objectively, finitely, formally, and thereby rescue us from a flux of emotion that might otherwise be very unpleasant. And yet in the act of concentrating on that body we are endangered, because we might come to be what we call materialists. We might so identify with the gross material body that we come to believe that the gross material body is the only reality there is. If we think this is not a real danger, all we have to do is examine the teachings of those psychological schools that actually teach that mechanistic behaviorism is the truth of the human psyche. They think that the human being is a machine. Conditioned reflexes are man. The bundle of conditioned reflexes are man, and he must respond to stimuli of a certain order in a certain formal way because he is a machine. Now, if this is so, all human values are rubbish. They are just an illusion. There is a real danger of focusing on the material world and actually believing that the material world is reality. It ignores other worlds that we know about and experience very well, the world of feeling, the world of field forces, magnetic forces and so on, which we know are not material in any sense of the word. They are forces that are not material. Matter is a specific mode of force, but force is not a mode of matter. So we are presented with a twofold anxiety. Prior to the first rotation, the first establishment, the first abstraction of the idea of a rotation, there is God, that is the absolute sentient power. And this power contains within itself, from itself by its inherent nature, free motion and intersections of free motion within itself. The free motion constitutes the grace of God, and the intersection points constitute the logos or form of God. You can see that simultaneous equilibration in the presence of anxiousness, the second part of this question, must be a truth, because prior to this rotating process, which we call the temporal process, there is only simultaneous equilibration. The equilibration is quite simply a dynamic one, it isn't a static one. It simply means that as soon as motion is initiated in any place whatever, then motion is initiated in all places, such that the totality of motions within the absolute cancel out, so that the total of it is equilibrated. And this is done not serially as in the time process, and therefore we have to say it is a process of simultaneous equilibration, and yet it is accompanied throughout by this twofold anxiousness, the anxiousness of the void and the anxiousness of the bound body. We find this in ourselves very easily. If we feel very deeply inside, we do not like to be isolated from all other bodies. If we go into a nice desert place alone, and we make sure that we cut off all communications before we go, we begin to feel a bit queer. The reason is that we cannot be aware that we exist except as centers of reaction to stimuli. We need other centers to stimulate us so that we know that we have our existence. And on the other hand, if we don't go into the desert and we concentrate on the relations of physical bodies, and so we bring ourselves to other individuals, we discover they start taking up an awful lot of our time. We find we haven't got enough time for ourselves. And we're in this peculiar situation where if we know a lot of people, we actually have no time to develop ourselves. And if we know nobody whatever, we can't develop ourselves. Because we need these other beings to stimulate us and make us aware of the potentials of our own actuality. If serial presentation is internal to the universe, then the first rotation would appear to be simultaneous equilibration. This is obviously so. We have seen that the serial presentation is simply the product of a rotation, an arc, part of the arc of which, viewed finitely, generates seriality. That is to say, if we draw a nice big circle, stand back from the circle, we can see the whole circle at one go. And this is non-serial. The whole circle is one simultaneous being. But if we stand at any point and shield ourselves with sense organs, like our eyes, which point forwards and not backwards, we can only see one portion of the whole rotation at a time. And we have to point the eyes, continuously turn the eyes round, in order to see the whole circle, which we can see in one moment if we stand far enough back. If we become involved in the situation, seriality arises from our involvement. And that's the relative speed of mental processes. A person who is involved in a situation always thinks the situation is getting out of hand, because he's finiting, he's concentrating his attention, and in the act of doing so, he's seeing only a tiny portion of reality, and in order to get enough data by this narrow vision, he has to scan very rapidly the whole thing. In other words, he has to hurry up, like man, to see as much as another man standing back from the situation. When we stand back, we slow down our mental processes. We see more in less time. If we stand at infinity, we see the whole process in no time. But if we stand at any finite distance, the greater the distance, the more we see in less time. Now, certainly the first rotation, when it comes to be, because it is the product of simultaneous forces of in-pressing and out-pressing, and it is Saturn and Jupiter, which press in opposition immediately one upon the other. The opposition is bred immediately. One does not press, and then an interval of time, and then the other one. But as soon as one presses, the other one presses. So there's an immediacy of opposition between Saturn and Jupiter. So the whole primary wheel of being, the cosmic logos, comes to be, when it comes to be at all, simultaneously, and by the displacement of the energies within it throughout itself, is equilibrated. So we can say that the first rotation is simultaneously equilibrated in all its parts. This means that the generation of the macrocosmic sphere, which makes time possible and serialization possible within it, is simply the product of the Saturn-Jupiter opposition of forces, and it carries us on to the next part of the problem. Can it be said that the Father is not sure whether the Son will manifest himself? Now, the Father is quite sure, providing you define sure accurately. Let's see what sure means, and then we'll see. The root of it, SR. Now, it means simply the spirit is vibrating. The introduction of the letter unit simply means the power going, the spirit power going along and differentiating. If we anglicize it and put an I in it, he says, sir, an English sir, a gentleman entitled to be called sir, is simply a free being. He is free because he has teeth. He is a serrated man. And this means to say that he is aware of the mode of generation of the teeth, that is, of the discrete entities. And we know that in a continuum there are no absolutely discrete entities. There are only vibrations, impulses, expulses from centers, and that to find the discrete we have to discover centers of intersection of forces, zones of turbulence, and we must then deliberately abstract these centers of force to consider them as finites, and then deliberately ignore the intersecting forces that keep them in being and pretend they don't exist. So if I draw two lines crossing each other to represent forces intersecting, and where they intersect, I put a circle to represent a zone of turbulence. If I want to believe in discrete particles, I have to posit a series of such intersections zones of turbulence, and then I must deliberately ignore the lines that are intersecting to produce them, and postulate that in the place where those lines are, there is nothing. Then I can believe in the intersection points as finite material entities in their own right. This is the ground of atomistic materialism. It is an erroneous ground because it ignores the actual causative forces that keep these centres in being. But the word sir, sure, and so on simply means the spirit is vibrating. And in its vibrating, it is giving you the opportunity of looking from wave crest to wave crest, and then deliberately abstracting and pretending that that little crest and that little crest are really discrete entities standing in their own right, and that they've nothing to do with the waveform of the sensitive part of the absolute beneath them. Now, to be sure in this sense is to see clearly the differentiation, to see the differences. Spirit is equivalent to awareness, R is equivalent to differences. So to be aware of the differences is to be sure. Now God is absolutely aware of all these differences, and therefore he is absolutely sure. Now the sun is simply the macrocosmic logos generated by the intersection of all the forces there are. As these forces are intersecting, and they are intersecting within, and by virtue of the sentient power which constitutes them, that sentient power is aware of every point within itself. It is aware, it sees, the differentiation points. It is therefore absolutely sure that the sun is. Now what does manifest mean? Is the Father sure whether the sun will manifest himself? The Father is quite sure that the Son is an eternal being, because the Son is the term that we use for the formal functioning of the Father generative power. He is absolutely sure that the Son has this eternal being. What does manifest mean? It means that it is made fast in order to be evaluated. Remember the root MR, MA, MAR means to evaluate. Relative motion thing, man to measure, and fast and fast on the same. To make it fast in order to evaluate it continuously. Will the sun be manifest? The sun is eternally manifest, by definition. So there is no problem here of the Father being in doubt about whether the sun will manifest. The Father cannot be in doubt about whether the sun will manifest unless we understand the meaning of doubt. Now doubt means doubleness, and the sun is the intersection point of all these forces, and all the intersecting forces held in the consciousness of the Father and the form, the logos of the sun, these are a double presentation to the Father. We can say in a real sense that God is in doubt, that is in doubleness, because he keeps himself free and bound simultaneously. But this doubt must not be construed as a negative. This doubt is the ground of God's free domain, that is his initiative, whereby he can do or not do anything whatever. You may remember that Descartes, trying to become a philosopher, thought he would be a good philosopher by refusing to believe anything whatever, and trying to get down to the basis that was absolutely certain. And he reduced himself by doubting until he came down to one proposition that he could not doubt. Namely, he could not doubt that he was doubting. Doubting is a kind of thinking, so he says, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am. If he had said, I doubt, therefore doubting exists, that is certain. That would have been something, providing he defined certain. The point is that when he did come down to the level of doubt, he had come down to the level of certainty. This much was certain, that he was doubting. Doubt exists. In the same way, this much is certain of God. Freedom exists. but freedom is doubt. Freedom is free and dome. Which shall you stress? Now, if you stress dome, all the materialists will shout out, you're on our side. And the mystics will kick you in the pants. But if you stress free, then all the mystics will shout, you're on our side, and the materialists will kick you in the pants. God is too canny for this, so he shouts both at once in the mystical word freedom. But then this freedom concept is so very tricky to handle that the greatest philosophers the world has seen are in doubt about its ultimate significance. In fact, it's an unresolved problem in philosophy. Does freedom exist? This is a big question in philosophy. It's not a question that has been resolved by noting that the word freedom is really two words. This they don't do. They treat it as if it were a single entity and argue about whether it exists or not, as if it actually meant free. And it doesn't mean free. It means free, bound. Free, dome. All that is, all that was, and always will be is the statement about this elementary proposition that we formulate in the statement, or our question, what is that which the omnipotent God cannot do? The answer is, he cannot cease. He is, if he is a God. And whether omnipotent or not, if he has been, he cannot cease to be whatever he is. So this omnipotent God is immediately limited by this one fact. He cannot cease to be himself. We cannot conceive, no matter how hard we try, the elimination of that to which we refer when we refer to the ultimate. We can eliminate individual men. We can take our most brilliant philosophers, brilliant scientists. We can conceptually eliminate them, or we can eliminate them with machine guns, if we are extreme right-wing in our senses. We can eliminate them because they are finite. But the field in which they existed, in which they were born, in which they grew, lived, became sick and died, this field we cannot conceive to be other than it is. No matter how many corpses we litter the place with, we cannot remove the space from our awareness. We cannot conceive the removal of space. We can conceive the removal of bodies. We can even conceive by a bit of juggling that the term space should only be used for that which is in between bodies. And if we remove bodies, then we would say, oh well, we will stop using the word space because it is only meaningful if we put bodies in. But still, this is a kind of attempt to get rid of the problem of space. The real fact that we observe is that there are centers of heightened consciousness where we are, the individuated centers of awareness, and we observe that from these centers, awareness diminishes normally between centers, and we tend to think that the space between centers of awareness is what we are pleased to call void or empty. Without bothering to observe that empty and void both mean the same thing, namely power and pleasure. This question of anxiety of God is very, very important, because if what we have said is true, that God cannot cease to be himself, and if God is the all in all, that is to say, if he is the absolute space occupier and the absolute being, he is the sentient power that cannot cease to be himself, cannot cease to be aware that he is himself, then as he is all there is and there is nothing other than him, whatever qualities he has essentially in himself, in putting his spirit into existence, as in the Genesis statement, and he breathed his spirit into man and man became a living soul, whatever attributes God has, if man's spirit is from God, then man likewise has the same attributes, because they are the attributes of God's spirit. And therefore, if God has this peculiar duality of apprehension in himself, this anxiety state that we have just discussed, then man's spirit must have the same dual experience in it. Now we know that it has, from the simple self-examination. We know that we have two basic fears. One of them is that there is nobody about to play with, and the other is that we are tied in our own body and cannot escape from our playmates. This double fear in us is the thing that peculiarly preoccupied the existentialists. When they say that the universe is grounded in Sorge und Angst, in concern and anxiety, they are referring to this duality of space and existential entity. Every existential center of individuated awareness, every person, has a problem. Can he bring himself up to the level of being that pleases him? Can he bring himself up to a level of being where he can resist the forces of disintegration acting upon him? If he cannot attain that level of integration, then he's going to be taken to bits, and he is faced with the fear of the void. On the other hand, if he can get integrated, then anxiety is just as strong, because he might conceivably integrate himself in a wrong way and then not be able to break it. It is quite possible to get a wrong pattern in the mind and so to empower it that you can't break it. That an individual cannot break it alone without help. He might be so trapped within a conceptual framework that whatever he looks at is distorted by the form that he has integrated. And this premature integration is a kind of hell, because the person who is in it knows that he is deficient, that he is well integrated, but that his basic concept around which he is integrated is dead. It is a misapprehension. Now, is there any way whatever of avoiding a wrong integration? The answer is yes. Refuse to integrate. Now, this is the doctrine of the Bodhisattva. It's a very subtle psychological trick. You know that in the Mahayana Buddhism of northern India and Tibet, as opposed to the school in Ceylon, Hinayana, in the northern school, they do not believe in going to heaven. In the southern school, each man thinks he ought to get there first. In the northern school, they're much more subtle and say, let us get there last. Because if we manage to be last, we will see more than the other fellows. We are less likely to make a false integration. The fellows who stampede towards integration in order to secure themselves against the void cling to any form that offers security, and they impose on themselves a very peculiar illusion of freedom. It's really a kind of individuated system of reactivity such that it throws away anything whatever presented from outside mechanically, because it has a concept that it must not be imposed on from outside, and thus it rejects all stimuli as possible sources of bondage. So that in the Southern School Buddhism, we find this individuated tendency of the Save Yourself School, and a man who has saved himself has disappeared. He's no use to anybody else who gives him no assistance. He has gone, if he is telling the truth. But in the attempt to pursue this, he stands in danger of identification with a false concept of freedom. Now, to offset this danger, the Northern School fabricated the doctrine of the Bodhisattva, which is simply the person who renounces nirvana for himself until everybody else is in. And this is a very safe way of avoiding premature integration around a false concept. Whatever the concept is, you recognize by the nature of the concept, it is a circumscribing and therefore binding form. Now, if we want to identify with the absolute, that is, if we want to stress the free, we must continuously break down every definition that is imposed upon us, simply because it is a definition, it is a circumscription. Just recently, talking with a highly intelligent fellow about this, he cried out, "It is very nice, but I cannot afford it. I'm a man of responsibility." I cannot afford to throw away the concepts that I have built and which actually bring in for me large amounts of money and reputation and so on. It was something like the young man that Christ said it was rather hard for him because he had too much money. He couldn't get into the kingdom of the free because he was clinging to the dome. Now, it doesn't matter how big the dome is, the dome cannot be as big as this place that surrounds it. And consequently, if we are to prefer to be free, we must transcend every dome, that is, every definition, whatever. There's a very real danger in premature integration under false concept, as you know, if you get into conversation with any person who is strongly formulated in any given field. It doesn't matter whether it's religion or science or art. If he is strongly, emotively identified with any given finite form, he is blinded to the truth of other forms. So we can take any of the so-called great religions and find devotees in them who cannot see any good whatever in another religion. We can find that certain men will say, we must observe Christmas Day because it is the birthday of our Lord Jesus Christ. And you come along and say, as a matter of fact, the 25th of December is a day that was used prior to Christianity for another Saviour, and that they borrowed it, and that in actual fact there is no record, contemporary record of Christ, saying that that was his birthday. Now, some so-called Christians become a bit upset at it being suggested for a moment that a pagan festival should have been utilized by the truth-loving Christians. They become very upset. And they can become so upset they can fall out with the fellow who points out this to the fact that he hadn't fabricated, it's not his fault that these things happen. And if he does point it out, there will be trouble. Now, any person who is prematurely integrated around any finite concept whatever is automatically excluding himself from a larger truth. We can say, if we want, that Christianity is the truest religion in the world, providing we do a little trick. If we take the temporal Christianity, the one that was fabricated about 2,000 years ago, and say that this is the truth, and we believe that it started then, we're in trouble, because we can find wonderful ethical, moral, and spiritual statements at least 600 years beforehand, from the great philosophers in Greece, in China, in India, in Babylon, in Egypt, and so on. We can find tremendous thinkers thinking and saying the same moral platitudes that appear in the New Testament. They are not new. How then can we say that Christianity is the whole truth? The answer is only this. We must say that the temporal appearance of Christ was merely the temporal ratification of an eternal fact. And then we have to say that Christianity is really Christianity. We have to say that the Chris in it means a circle. We have to say that the chrism, the oil of baptism, is a circle. We have to say that circumcision is a circle. We have to say that any kind of segregation of beings from the objective sense world is a baptism and is an incarnation of truth. We can do this by saying that if there is anything true, whatever, in any religion prior to Christianity, that it was, as some of the theologians have said, to appropriate it, it was a foreshadowing of the temporal Christian revelation cast into the time process from eternity beforehand to prepare the nations to receive the truth. Now, by doing this kind of mental process, we can say that Christianity is the truth. But if we are consistent, we will have to say likewise that Buddhism is the truth too, because the Buddha is so called because he is enlightened. And it says in the Gospel that the light that lights every man that came into the world is this light that is the Christ. Now, unless we are to pretend that the term illuminated mentally and spiritually means one thing to an Indian and another thing to an Englishman, we will have to say that Gautama the Buddha, who was illuminated, had seen the same fact that Christ saw. and that the difference in the two messages was simply the difference in the contextual need of the societies in which they found themselves. That at the time Gautama appears, say about the 5th century BC, the problem to be presented isn't quite the same that it will be in a very turbulent Middle East where Jesus appears and says the same thing, and unlike Buddha or Lao Tse or any of the other sages, gets himself crucified for saying. There aren't sufficient forces organized before him of the material order, say of the Roman order, of the rabbinical order of the synagogue, to get hold of this man who is uttering this truth and to kill him. In fact, at the earlier period, we can see that the Greeks and the Indians and the Babylonians, Chaldeans, the Egyptians, were not aware of the tremendous danger of the truth to the state. We find in the case of Socrates that he is telling a kind of truth very similar to Christ, and as far as ethics is concerned, exactly as high, so that William Blake could say, if morality were Christianity, then Socrates were Christ. His moral level is the same, and we find that he's 70 years old before the state finally become aware that he's doing them no good, he's upsetting them. And even there, they're not quite sure, because they give him an alternative. They say, if you're prepared to walk away, we won't ask you to drink much hemlock. He replies, I'm too old to go somewhere else. And if I do go, I won't shut up, I'll just go on like I am now. So I might as well drink it here. He has an alternative, and he refuses it. He is crucified by his own will, then and there. All they do to him is prepare the cup. He picks it up, and he drinks it. Now Christ uses the same image. He said this is a cup that he must drink. He argues the case with himself in Gethsemane about whether it's worth drinking or not, and he decides, considering the terrific effect he's going to have annoying people for a couple of thousand years, that it is worth it. Socrates goes through a similar process and finishes up drinking his cup. The only essential difference is that Jesus annoys the rabbis so much that they themselves get terribly annoyed with him and nail him on a piece of wood. And this symbolically is a cup. And it's the same cup that everybody has had to drink, namely the cup of bitter experience in the face of presenting the truth, which belongs to spirit and is therefore free, into the domain of the bound, which must therefore resent it. When we look at any circle, no matter how big, we observe that the fact that it is a circle means it has finite capacity. It cannot take in the significance of the absolute and hold it. And therefore, a very old saying says, it is not for the truth to be kept down to the size of man. It is for man to grow up to the truth. No matter how big your concept, if it is a definable, it is excluding, by the act of defining, an infinity of significances of the absolute beyond. So we can see here that for all normally identified people in a finite situation, the anxiety situation consists in an alternation of fear of the void, that is isolation from other beings, and fear of existing as an individual and being pinned on this existence. In fact, being locatable by other beings. They know where you are because you have a body. They can bring pressure to bear on you because you have a body. If you have a body of existence, you can be a pet. If you have no body of existence, the void swallows you. These two kinds of anxiety, alternating down the lifeline of any given individual, worry him into the grave. But if he can see both simultaneously, in the supreme act of double perception, which you could call absolute doubt, if you will, that is the absolute double presentation of intersection of forces equals generation of finite point, and existence of finite point proves transcendent forces to exist. And when we see that we are no more to be afraid of the void than we are of having a body, or we should be afraid equally of both, then we can abandon this in the supreme anxiousness and understand what it means to be anxious deliberately and on purpose. That is to say, take up your salvation and work it out in fear and trembling. That is to say, you very, very carefully watch your differentiation in yourself. And this working out one's salvation in fear and trembling simply means watching this vacillation of the motive to see every day finer and finer and finer that at one moment you're reaching out for a little reassurance from another body that you exist. And the next day you are terrified of your loss in the void. And as you get more and more aware of this, you will discover that perhaps long periods of your life were in fear of the void, and then long periods fear of being tied in your body. Long periods of fear of responsibility placed on you because you're a physical body, and long periods of fear of absorption in the void and being unnoticed by other beings. Now, it might be that you do this for years, alternating. Then you might do it for months, alternating. Then it might be for weeks. It might be for days. Now, if you practice and become what is called in the New Testament quick, mercurial, you can discover that you have within a split second a fear of the void and a fear of existing rattling around each other, vibrating. And then, if you can just take the extra leap to see them in the now simultaneously presented, that you are afraid of the void and the non-void simultaneously, then quite suddenly you see what the Buddhists meant when they taught that the void is a plenum void. It is a full void. It is a void full of form, and that it is abstract thinking to believe that you can take the form out of the void or the void away from the form and have either above. You cannot. And at this point you get your absolute security in the double presentation of the existent body and the void beyond it. And both are equally valid, because the void is the field and the body within it is simply the reference point within the field, generated by the field itself by simple impulse.
What about the fear of being committed to this alternating process?
The fear of being committed to the alternating process. If you observe your life to be actually something of this order, and anybody who observes their life must see it to be so, the fear is not of the simultaneous presentation, because where they're simultaneously presented, you cannot fear it. The fear is, if you have a fairly long period of void fear, and a fairly long period of the committed to the body fear, and you are afraid that this alternation, the separation of the two, might be prolonged, then you have a good ground for being uncomfortable. Because factually, the fear of the void alone, without the fear of the body as well, is very unpleasant. And the fear of identification with your physical body is very unpleasant. But if you put both together simultaneously, it isn't unpleasant at all. You remember that Spinoza said, if you can see that something is absolutely necessary, you cannot grieve about it. You cannot worry about a logical necessity that is utterly inescapable. You can only worry about a thing if there is a remote possibility of doing something about it. So if you define a right angle accurately, you cannot worry about it. It's not a subject matter for worry. If you define a circle as a line described, all the parts of which are equidistant from a single center, you can't worry about that. You can only worry about those things in which you have an alternative of evidence. that in simultaneous co-presentation of opposites, this cannot occur, and therefore you cannot worry.
So what about this conceptual anomaly then, where you can get this idea of pointing to the seat, which arises, I suppose,
wanting to cease to exist can only arise providing existence is made sufficiently painful. It's a mere reflex response from a painful existence. And if you could feel the ache in the void to be equivalent to the pain of existence, they cancel out. You see, it's a false concept, this, that allows a person to do it. He wants to cease to exist because existence is painful, only because he's pretending the void itself doesn't ache. But the void itself is sentient power in between centers of precipitation. And in between centers of precipitation, it is aching to precipitate. So as soon as you get off the center of precipitation, you come into the ache of the void. So you might as well stand between the two. Factually, nobody ever yet wanted to cease to exist unless it became unpleasant. And the will to the void itself depends on an abstract, intellectual, wrong assessment of what the void is. To will to the void is to will to believe in what their priests call annihilation. There will be no awareness whatever, therefore no problem. But as soon as you get off the center of identification into the space between, you merely enlarge your identification. You haven't removed it. And that with which you are now identified is trying to create a center to identify with.
How would it resolve this then, this first belief?
Well, of course, he taught the doctrine of the mean. Not the Aristotelian. Mm-hmm. He said that whatever you do, driven by desire, will drive you into opposites. Because if something is very, very beautiful, you chase it. And it might get away, and therefore you're afraid. So wherever there is pleasure in the vision, there is fear that the vision might be removed. So he says, reduce down to the middle the fear and the pleasure. Cut them down. Just in the same way we say of a manic depressive on his sine wave, he goes up and becomes very elated, and then he goes down and becomes depressed. Now, we say to him, when you're going up to be elated, you have a lot of strength. Use that strength to pull yourself down towards the middle line. If you succeed in lowering your wave, you cannot be depressed in the next half cycle any lower than you were elated above it. So if you can pull down your elations lower and lower, your depressions get shallower and shallower until finally you come onto an even line. And this is a dynamic concept of the mean, where every elation at a pleasure will be pulled down, and therefore there can be no subsequent depression. Now to an ordinary elated person this seems terrible, because he says, what am I going to live for? Because he had no experience whatever of what it means to pull this down deliberately instead of it being knocked down. If you pull down the energy of elation, that energy is yours. It simply changes phase and becomes a higher frequency energy and gives you greater awareness, and the amount of nervous stimulation per second of a pulled down man is far in excess of an elated man who is so far out of himself by himself that he doesn't even know that he's enjoying it. Some people get so elated, they say they're besides themselves. They're certainly not getting the benefit of it. Whereas if you manage to pull it down onto the median line, you can actually quite consciously get the full benefit, because a number of nerve endings that transmit pleasure responses through the body is not decreased by learning how to control yourself. But it seems, generally, the control is the same thing as loss of pleasure. But this is only because of bad education. Because when the child is enjoying itself, somebody comes along and stops it. And so it gets the idea that the word control yourself means give up pleasure. It doesn't mean any such thing. But that's how it arises. Go and find out where little Willie is and what he's doing and stop it. This is the rule. And here we see that the mode of education actually imposes on us, if we're not careful, a belief that control is a bad thing. In fact, your affective, emotional response to the word control isn't right. You don't like the word control, do you? Not from your feeling center. It seems very clear that is, go and control yourself. It means put that lolly away, you've had five already. You must stop whatever you're doing. And this is not true in the real sense. When you impose on yourself with your own awareness and you pull down the energy that would otherwise elate itself, let itself right out of the identification with the organism and thus disperse and lose its value. When you pull it down and pack yourself into the receiving organism so that your awareness is exactly equivalent to your body, then your capacity for the real pleasure within it, using pleasure in its highest sense, is far in excess of that that you experience in an elated state. You know, part of the practice of yoga breathing is to stop breathing further than your skin. You practice first of all with a candle. You hold it about there and you try to breathe without disturbing the candle flame. And then you bring it nearer and nearer and nearer until you can just let the air trickle out of your nose and go up by its own heat. You're not allowed to block it on the throat. You have to do this on the diaphragm and lower ribs so that you're perfectly relaxed. But you must hold that candle and let the air trickle out of your nostrils and go up by its own heat. When you're doing this, you are controlling not only your breath, but your emotional response. And your awareness is just up to the limit of your frame of reference, your physical body. And when you do this, your awareness of the body's response capacity is far higher than it could possibly be if you were elated. When you're elated, you're beyond your physical body and you cannot see what is going on. You're so excited that you don't even know. There's a certain lady we know didn't know that when she stroked somebody in her delight, she knew about his neck. And he had to be put on one side for resuscitation. This is a real experience where elation rather overstimulated the system. So if we can, in fact, appreciate this real fact that we have a double fear of the void and the fear of being pinned in our physical bodies, and we deliberately observe that these fears are present all the time. Take a boy and his girl. They're going out together, they go out together, perhaps in the early stages they see each other every night. This goes on for several weeks until a girlfriend of the girlfriend says, you are seeing too much of him, it's not good for you, come to the pictures with me. So she decides to go to the pictures. This has broken the precedence of 5 weeks of every night cinema going on this path. Now, at this moment, this fellow panics madly that the world has fallen apart. He has taken a night off. Suddenly, he's precipitated into the void. He experiences this. This is a fairly universal experience. And then, a few years later, he is married. And she is saying, why are you not taking me to the pictures every night, every 5 weeks, like you used to? And he is saying, my God, if I didn't have this body, I wouldn't be here. And this is the kind of purpose that goes on. If you can affirm a pair of opposites simultaneously, the void and the existential body, simultaneously you will stop worrying. So that when wifey calls, instead of wanting to disappear into the infinite distance, you will suddenly realize the ache of the infinite void and stay on what's telling you.
Mm-hmm.